Berkman Center. My name is Urs Gasser. I'm the executive director of the Berkman Center and kind of the host together with Ethan and Daza of this meeting. And we are delighted to welcoming you and to have the opportunity in a quite informal way to talk and think about crowdsourcing approaches to online dispute resolution. Now, many of you may be wondering, like, you know, what the purpose of this group is. Actually, there is no straightforward answer to that. I think that's part of the assignment today, to figure out what this group is about. So we just thought, working on different bits and pieces regarding crowdsourced online dispute resolution, at some point, almost by coincidence, we thought it would be great to team up, to pool our knowledge. Obviously, each of us has been involved either in research, building tools, thinking about particular use cases, developing use cases. And so at some point, we decided we should team up and actually sit down together and start thinking about collaborations. And you know, each of you has his or her own story and relationships, and I think we'll learn more when we do a quick round of introduction just in a minute. But again, so this is a very initial workshop. However, as we will see as we move forward, there are also specific project ideas where we would appreciate your inputs and comments on. Certainly in the first part of the workshop, we'll also have an opportunity to address more general and conceptual questions, something that I'm personally particularly interested in from a Berkman perspective. So it's kind of a rich menu in front of us, a mixture between theoretical, conceptual questions as well as more specific project-oriented questions, and all that kind of in the spirit of collaboration and the aim to find synergies and connection points among us. So without further introduction, maybe one thing that I should mention, this is recorded, right? So whenever you know you would like to speak off the record, just let us know. Otherwise, you know, it will be posted, I think, on the Law Lab Wiki, Berkman Wiki, and you will...
And we would like to repost on the eCitizen Foundation site as well, as part of our commitment to transparency and openness to the meetings we're having on projects for public infrastructure.
Is it going to be posted in transcribed form or the actual audio form?
It would be audio form, yeah.
And I've got a little bit of auxiliary video for some of the key moments.
Ethan?
Well, hi. Nice to be here. Nice to be here again. Thank you, Urs, for hosting this. I'm going to introduce myself. I think that's what we're doing here, rather than I don't want to get started just talking. So I'm Ethan Katch. I'm the director of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution, located at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I'm listed as professor of legal studies at the University of Massachusetts. I was that until about 4 weeks ago. So. I've shed that title, or at least that exact title. I'm interested in, and have been for a number of years, in online dispute resolution. Technology, in my view, creates disputes without one having to work at it. Resolving disputes is hard. The heart of my connection here, I haven't really devoted significant time to the idea of crowdsourcing in online dispute resolution, but my point of view is that dispute resolution is an information and communications-based activity. Essentially, I think, the only distinction between the various forms of dispute resolution is how information is managed. Maybe war is a separate example, but different example, but even there, these days, information is key. So, look forward to the conversation today.
Thanks, Ethan. And I'm Daza Greenwood, and I'm the Chief Policy Officer for the eCitizen Foundation, who is really pleased to be able to bring together this diverse group of stakeholders representing expertise in law and policy, public sector, academia, technology, et cetera, to take a look at this issue. And my background is as I was a practicing attorney for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in Information Technology Division. And now I am working at this nonprofit, helping to create public infrastructures. And this particular set of tests that we're conducting and the project that we're discussing today is part of a suite of things that we're doing at the foundation with Dialogue and with some other civic infrastructure. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to being of service to all the stakeholders that are involved in this dialogue and in the test that will result. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Zertin. I'm Deputy General Counsel with the Information Technology Division with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So I'm here because our clients are way ahead of us, and we're trying to get up to speed and hopefully get ahead of our clients on using some of these technologies and collaboration methodologies in the public sector. So hopefully get some information and get ahead of all the agencies and our clients in this space.
I'm Scott David, Scott David with K&L Gates, a law firm. We represent eCitizen Foundation. The reason we're doing this as a pro bono project, the reason that this was of interest to me is I work in the information and identity law area, and that's not an area that his law firms don't say they have an information and identity group yet, but they will, because the reason in particular that I'm interested in this project is what I've observed over the most recent years is that the level of complexity of interaction has ramped up significantly because the level of technology mediation of commercial transactions and social interactions is increased really exponentially, quite literally. And the tools that we have for dealing with things legally are falling behind rapidly because of they're not increasing in robustness exponentially. And so it's very interesting to me to understand what kind of alternative mechanisms there will be to be complementary to our existing legal structures to try to address all this stuff. So, my story.
Hi, I'm Caroline Nolan. I'm a project coordinator for the Law Lab and a research associate here at the Berkman Center. I'm definitely interested in the conceptual questions, the theoretical questions that Urs and Joey have been working on. I'm also quite interested in the diverse range of use cases, particularly as they relate to projects at the Berkman Center. In particular, I think of the Stop Badware project and also our work on the Global Network Initiative, which is seeking to come up with alternative dispute resolution systems. So very much looking forward to the conversation.
So I'm Diane Mueller. I apologize for being a few minutes late. I'm with the XBRL Consortium. I work on XML standards for financial reporting. And I'm interested in this project because of how it's applicable to recovery acts and appropriation acts and tagging deeply into the legislation process and the budgeting and the actuals with TARP funding and being able to expose that information for citation and interaction for citizen scrutiny. So I'm quite interested in hearing what everybody's doing. And I'm a tools vendor. I have tools.
Excellent.
My name is Chris Babbitts. I'm a clinical fellow here at the Berkman Center. I work with the Cyber Law Clinic, which is a four-credit clinical legal education program affiliated with Harvard, has students working throughout the academic year for some Berkman-affiliated clients and a lot of external clients like Stephanie and her team, and on issues relating to intellectual property technology and that sort of thing. And I'm here because these kinds of issues are of interest to a lot of our clients, and so I'm curious to hear what everybody has to say.
I'm David Evans, Chief Scientist at Just Systems Corporation, a colleague of Diane's. Over the years, I've developed a lot of technology, especially related to information and decision sciences, and I'm here in part because I think there may be some technology components of this problem that we can address, and I'm interested in learning.
I'm Chris Peterson. I am a summer research intern for ORS here at the Berkman Center. I am also an associate at the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution. And until 4 weeks ago, I was a student of Ethan's. And I guess I'm here because after spending most of my adolescence creating disputes on the internet, I'm converted, at least mostly, into trying to help resolve them.
He's hacking with his toes right now.
I'm Joey Morton. I'm also a Berkman research intern. I've been working with Urs and Caroline to do some research on the topics of crowdsourcing and online dispute resolution and thinking about how to bring the two together conceptually and practically. So it's really exciting for me to have everybody finally in the same room together so we can put our minds together and talk about the stuff I've been working on for the past month.
Hi, I'm Daniel Bennett. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for ESIS and Foundation. And although I'll be talking about the practical side of standards developed necessary for doing some of the crowdsourcing, my background is working in Congress to help people communicate with government. And one of the important things and the great aspect of being here at the Berkman Center is to be able to understand those needs of governments to be able to communicate are bound by laws and regulations, some of which sometimes gets passed the techno folks who just say, this is how to build a widget, and need really the help from the legal layer to understand how things need to be dealt with in terms of the requirements of providing an open and well-developed system to allow the public to take part in public policy discussions, which weren't possible in a way that they are now, using online dialogues, etc. So.
So this is wonderful. Again, welcome and thanks for taking the time. Probably just a word on the agenda. As you can take from, we have, of course, flexibility also, to adjust the agenda as we move forward. But this is kind of just, initial attempt to structure our discussion a little bit. What we thought is that we could start, as I indicated earlier, with some conceptual, bigger picture questions, probably spend about an hour on that, and then getting more concrete, so moving from the theory level to the application and practical level, a session that will be moderated by you, Ethan. Also, learning from each other what have been prior experiences while developing ODR tools in various contexts, obviously, and what does that mean when we now face a different use case or a particular use case, which is more in the public policy sphere, what are lessons learned from the past, and then in kind of a third part of this meeting to focus on one particular project, and DASA will basically lead us through the various steps and again, discuss the various questions, some of them again, bigger questions, some of them rather specific questions. So it will be again a mixture between conceptual issues as well as very straightforward practical design questions and how do we resolve it, what's the best way to move forward while developing a concrete tool that hopefully will be played very soon and that we can experiment with and learn from experiences by using a crowdsourced ODR tool in a public policy environment. So, can you give me the screen then? So, if you allow, and this is, I don't want to talk too long, too much. So, just as a starter, basically, what we've been trying to do, Joey and others here at the center, is to map like the state of play to the extent possible when it comes to crowdsourced ODR systems. Hi, John.
Hey.
It's John Clippinger.
Oh, sorry.
The Law Lab.
Sorry about
that. We got some room over here.
Hey, John, Daz Greenwood, nice to see you in person.
Good to see you.
Here's another.
Just finished introductions. John, do you want to continue?
I know where the law library is. I know where the science building is.
Yeah, I know where Leslie College is now. All right. There's some serious construction at the beginning of Everett Street.
I apologize.
Sorry, I should flag the construction.
John, you want to?
Yes, John Klippinger. I'm a co-director of the Law Lab. And our interest is in, well, and just these kind of things. My particular interest is in evolvable contracts and cloud law.
Which sounds pretty cool.
Well, I'll leave it ambiguous so you can project anything you want onto it. Right, right.
I want cloud law.
So, you mind?
To me, Mike Tirillo, thank you for the invitation. I have three interests here. One is we have recently, a firm that I'm associated with, developed an extensive open collaboration platform. And it is harnessing the ability to have large communities and networks govern themselves, communicate, put challenges up, and so forth. So that's one thing that I think might be of interest. In the spirit of full disclosure, we own a small company called CyberSettle, which is an online dispute resolution business that has been around for a long time. And so it's actually in the business of doing a number of things that you're talking about. And just by way of background, before my former life, I was the chief knowledge officer of KPMG International. So the ability to exchange intellectual property and knowledge is of great personal interest and passion. So I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Just very quickly, before you got here, by way of context, we identified a parallel project that the eCitizen Foundation is pursuing where there's some overlap looking at XBRL and legislation for, as a markup tool and some other rules-based languages. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's overlap there with your KPMG days.
And absolutely. And just one area of full disclosure, Beth Novak and I have been talking with Anish about taking this platform that I mentioned and applying it from Anisha's offices and Beth's office as a underlining platform against the President's Initiative for Open and Transparent Government. So that's another touch point.
Okay. That's good to know. Mostly, I guess it probably should, almost goes without saying, but first of all, I'm Daza Greenwood from the eCitizen Foundation. Thanks for coming. Thanks for the invitation. And mostly what we're doing here involves academic research and not industrial kind of development or joint development or something. And we're looking primarily just from the foundation's perspective in the civic engagement space for our first things actually to be open source oriented. But we're very open in a flexible way to work very closely with all kinds of stakeholders in the public and private sector, including those with proprietary software that accomplishes part of the, suite of functions that we're looking at. And we just have to be very clear, as we go forward from this meeting about where those intellectual property boundaries are. And actually, our general counsel is right here to make sure we always keep on the right side of the line. And but there's no reason in the world we can't all work very fruitfully together forever under the fullest ecology of licensing schemes.
Right. And I should say, in the spirit of that, the particular platform that we are developing for Beth would be available to you at no cost. We have developed a .org version of this that we are making available to all government entities, nonprofits, and NGOs. So it's simply
open source.
Some of the code itself is open source, but you would just log on to it. In fact, if you want later on today, I'll give you an actual challenge that's being run by the International, the Intelligent Transportation Society. It's a URL. You just go on, and basically you would manage it. So you would post it, manage it, and so forth. So I would provide the hosting and the coding, and it would be yours. You could private label it. You could do anything you want with it.
And then eventually, if it were taken up by the private by the public sector, you'd be willing to, have some sort of right. public oversight of it, or give it a nonprofit, or give it to a government agency, or
That's basically what we do. We are giving it to the U.S. government, for example, and we'll give it to any nonprofit.
I don't mean licensing. I mean transferring the rights to it.
The actual code itself? No.
Yeah, that's right. No. Okay, just so we understand where we're at.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
that's great.
I was trying to clarify.
All right, that's great. So, and then we may be offering alternative code that's open source that does the same thing under a single set of certifications.
That would be perfectly fine.
And the other aspect is that some of the work that may come out of the practical side that we're doing with the MIT Media Lab would abide by open standards, so that we want to share or for audit purposes be able to take a look at what's happening, that whatever we do can be, whatever happens behind doors in the proprietary, that's separate, but when it gets pushed out to lawyers or whoever, that it be used some set of standards, perhaps. Okay.
One of the hallmarks of it, it has to be transparent, not only from a user experience point of view, for those who actually want to use it, know what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And that Great. Would be absolutely
it's broadly compatible.
And
first.
Wait, one other thing for the new people. All of this is being recorded,
right.
So you're on the record unless you say otherwise.
Yeah. Just, fair enough.
And in addition, let me just say the purpose, there's different purposes, but the purpose for reporting it in the eCit for the eCitizen Foundation side is absolutely not to lock anybody into what they happen to be saying in these informal meetings right now, when we're talking in exploratory, research-oriented way about what we might do, or to lock even your company into anything that you may necessarily say. We're just sharing information in a collegial way at this time. And we're recording this for the purpose that people in the future that want to jump on can have a full record of what we talked about and where we're at in the project. That's why we're doing it, not to lock you in a legal way to what you're saying.
No problem. Just Great. One last comment. This was designed after 2 years of research with a group of academicians, a group of not only legal experts, but those that are really expert in what is today referred to as crowdsourcing and so forth. John Miller, who's now the digital chairman who owns Twitter and MySpace and so forth, is the non-executive chairman of this. So it's Great. Very consistent with what you're doing. This was developed by a group of people who have a passion and an interest for this space.
Sounds great. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah.
I'm Bruce.
So this is really interesting. And it shows to a certain extent like that we are, you know, have different approaches and different, I think, speeds. At the Berkman Center, I think we started working on and being interested in crowdsourced dispute resolution coming from Yochai Benkler's research and work on collaboration, cooperation in the digitally networked environment. And in a way, interested in peer production, not only in terms of production of information, knowledge, and entertainment, but also the production of governance, the peer production of governance structures. And that is what the Law Lab is looking into from various perspectives and as a very interdisciplinary research initiative. Now, the way we approached it, and what we're trying to do is not to do rapid prototyping in this particular case. We do it with other research endeavors. We try to build, you know, applications, platforms, play with it, improve it as you know, as one approach. What we've been doing here with regard to crowdsourced ODR is more to take two steps back and start with a literature review and trying to map what do we know at the conceptual and theoretical level about ODR and crowdsourcing mechanisms. And what I'd like to offer here is just a very brief overview of some of the issues. So this is very much an issue map. And then hopefully we, with your help, we can focus on some of the key issues, right, that you think these are really the relevant issues we need to talk about while developing tools and also pursuing different approaches than our own approach, where we have an interest in the first stage, at least, to do more the theoretical research work. So kind of the concept is straightforward, right? We try in a way to combine ODR, which is in itself obviously a quite an animal, right? ODR as various forms of alternative dispute resolution that incorporate the use of online technologies as part of dispute resolution processes, and basically combine that with crowdsourcing approaches. And again, our theoretical interest is motivated by this strand of research looking into the power of collaboration and peer production online. And you know, in a way, the challenge before us, or what we're interested in, is how can we combine the two elements on the one hand side, you know, much of the work you've been doing in the area on ODR, and what we already know about collaboration and the importance also of dispute resolution,
on collaborative platforms, going back to your earlier point, right, and combine the two things. Now, I think our initial literature review, and Joey has done much of the heavy lifting, shows that it's conceptually not so straightforward. So I have deep admiration for all the applications that apparently are already out there and in the pipeline and soon to be applied, but from the conceptual angle, it seems to me there is not so much literature actually out there, and there is not so much empirical findings available with regard to crowdsourced open online dispute resolution systems. So in a way, from the researcher's perspective and not the developer's perspective, I would argue there is still kind of need for more conversation and more research. And that's kind of our motivation and our interest in gathering and getting together today. So for instance, one of the things we've been struggling with when we started to do this research is basically what are the contexts that we have in mind when talking about crowdsourced ODR. One dimension obviously is like, what are the types of conflicts that we would like to approach with various tools that you may want to develop? And are there commonalities among different use cases, and can, you know, a tool and application that you develop be used in another context where, for instance, it's a transactional context versus a context, you know, where it's about civic engagement versus a context where it's about relationship stuff, right? Personal relations and disputes that arise in friendship, whatever it may be, say a Facebook setting or something like that. How specific do we need to be regarding the types of conflicts when we talk about CODR, as we name it? Of course, on offline versus online, one of the big questions too, which is not to say this is a new question. Obviously, it's a very old question, also very old, 10 years old, in the ODR context as such. Are we talking about crowdsourcing approaches to solve online disputes, or is it also a tool, a technology to address offline disputes, right, that are kind of addressed through digital technologies? Then, of course, it seems important to us while walking through and reviewing the literature also to make distinctions between the environment. Is it a private environment in terms of, are there private parties involved, say more like kind of an eBay setting versus a setting like, you know, Stephanie's, where you suddenly talk about governments and citizens, which obviously also from a legal perspective triggers an entire set of different considerations. Another contextual factor is certainly the scale of things, right? Are we talking about a dispute resolution where we have anticipate a small number of disputes and disagreements on certain things, say postings on a public forum, or is this about hundreds of thousands of disputes, as in the case of eBay, right? we're eager, millions actually are. We're really interested to understand like this scalability question. What does it mean at the conceptual level if we, you know, want to carefully start thinking about building tools, of course, also with regard to crowdsourcing in particular, how many members will we have in the crowd? Actually, one of the core questions, and Joey will comment on that in a second, is actually who is in the crowd? And when we talk about crowdsourcing approaches, and how do we identify crowds? And you know, that's in our view, conceptually, not such a trivial question. And I'm very eager to hear and learn from the tools you've developed, what approach you've been taking. Of course, also the stakeholders analysis, in our view, is quite important. Again, this has much to do, and I won't go through all that, of course, but has much to do with also the governance structure, the legal questions that are involved that we should keep in mind again, if we deal with governments, it might be very different as opposed to a setting where it's just about informal private parties, Facebook friends who actually, you know, think about the new way to resolve some disagreement that is really informal and kind of in the social space. So to take into account these constraints, I think, is important. So stakeholder analysis is something we found important reviewing the current literature, both on ODR as well as crowdsourcing approaches. Ethan mentioned it before. Obviously, it's not so straightforward in the first place what ODR means, right? Some of the platforms, and we will see examples later on, and one complete example, it's not so clear to us, at least. Are we talking really about negotiation, arbitration, or mediation when we look at some of the tools, or is it more in the area of actually recommendation and evaluation, or even voting systems, which is not necessarily the same thing, right? And so again, the need to clarify that, the theoretical desire at least, to understand what are we aiming for, what's the role also of the cloud, of the crowd, is the crowd equivalent to the function of a mediator, or is it basically collecting votes and aggregating it and get to a verdict of the herd, so to speak? This seems to be another important methodological question, and one that we're very interested in. Probably the most interesting area, however, and you mentioned that in the introduction session, is kind of what are some of the core principles we want or we have to take into consideration, and I would assume the answer again varies with regard to particular context and stakeholders. So this is again more a laundry list of things, but certainly issues that we probably should address. Just mention one, like interoperability as far as the infrastructure is concerned that we're developing. I think one of the lessons learned looking at online applications more generally is that interoperability is a key feature, right? And is increasingly, I would argue, very important and essential also for the development of the entire online space. And so that's something we certainly need to address. And, that goes obviously right into your court where we talk about standards and so forth. So this seems to be very, very important. Again, I don't want to go the entire list. To me, and I also hope to get more insights today, this is by no means a complete list. What are design principles regarding processes, right? It seems to me there are like general process requirements. You mentioned it actually. It's important to be transparent, right? We need to understand if we have a dispute use a crowdsourced dispute resolution system, we need to understand what's going on. It needs to be transparent with regard to the mechanics. Of course, there are lessons learned from various earlier use cases with regard, for instance, to simplicity and ease of use as another design feature. So I think there are general process design principles that we need to work through when developing tools, and obviously I think for the success of such applications, one of the key aspects is how to design it in a way where people perceive it to be a fair process that underlies the entire tool and or application, right? So notion of procedural fairness, how do we establish that? It's not a trivial question, actually. Just sitting in a lab and developing something is not, in my view, a guarantee that then later on people think this is a legitimate and fair tool that is offered to me to use. So in terms of long-term success, I think it's very important to think hard about what do we know about fairness, how do we build trust. there are also more specific and more concrete questions when it comes to crowdsourcing approaches, like participation, right? Who actually is the jury? Who's in the crowd? Who can participate, even use the tools? How much empowerment do we give to the individuals actually that are using the tool? Ethan, in various articles, pointed out that it's it changed the dynamic quite a bit, right? If you think about a moderated dispute resolution system, and you empower the individuals who actually have a dispute and give them tools how much they can interact and influence the process itself, that affects the very role of the moderator. And so to understand this complexity, that there is kind of that this ecosystem and that you need to reach an equilibrium, that's something that deserves our attention too. There is one aspect that we are at the Law Lab particularly interested in, is not only empowerment within a given process of dispute resolution, how much exchange can you do, how much information can you provide and request from the other party and so forth, but also empowerment in terms of selecting the dispute resolution system of your choice, right? Imagine that you're working at the Law Lab on a project where you can create your virtual firm. Now, if you create your virtual firm, think of it as like a firm in Facebook, right? The company in Facebook, virtual LLC. You may have very different needs with regard to dispute resolution if you're establishing this company with five college friends versus if you have a large scale online company with tens of thousands of contributors, say, to develop a new software, right? Maybe a very different need with regard to the design aspects of a conflict dispute resolution system, and to think about ways to offer almost a menu to users so that they can agree on the design of the dispute resolution system as such, seems to be a very important aspect of this idea of private law and empowering people to create their own governance systems in online spaces. One other thing just to mention is also, of course, we know from peer-to-peer file sharing systems and other applications that code is not neutral, right? The way we design interfaces, the way we structure platforms has an impact on the way in which the platform or application is used. One of the key questions, and again, very interesting from a conceptual perspective, is what will motivate the crowd actually to get involved in these resolutions? What are the incentives, and how can we build into the platform incentives, right? So that people actually participate in the resolution of disputes. This is, again, not a small task in my view, and I'm again very curious about the approaches you've taken. How much community building do we want to enable on such platforms, especially given the fact that, of course, you know from crowdsourcing approaches that diversity really matters in order to have kind of the benefits of crowdsourcing approaches, which is not only increased efficiency but also sound judgment, right? Sound resolutions of conflicts. We need some degrees of diversity of the crowd, within the crowd, the members of the crowd. How do we establish that by the design of the platform, so that the platform doesn't only attract whatever 35-year-old males from Europe, right? So,
fair-minded demographic.
The next design principle, and we will hear more about that for sure just in the video that we will display in a second, is about data collection practices, right? Well, to build a platform is one thing, but what are our data collection interests, so to speak, and how do we want to use the data that we collect? The beauty, of course, of all these tools is that you can basically ask the members of the crowd to, you know, provide whatever demographic information that you want. Of course, you want to be very careful about that for several reasons, because people usually don't like to fill in forms, and so this is another conversation, obviously related, but what is the data that we collect? How do we ensure privacy, authentication, identity? These are things that, that Scott and John obviously know much more about than I do. I think this is a key aspect while designing tools, and this is a very conceptual question, and I think it's underestimated, at least in some of the applications we've written. Just to finish here very quickly, I think another aspect we want to address early on is what's the governance structures of such crowdsourced ODRs. Certainly there is huge power in self-governance mechanisms, so I'm really eager to learn more about the use cases here represented around the table. Are there inbuilt systems of reputation? What are the trust mechanisms? How do you resolve meta conflicts about disagreements about judgments, right, among crowd members and so forth? So self-governance certainly very interesting. Also, how is the relation to third-party governance structures still kind of in the private law zone, accreditation? Obviously, there we have a lot of previous experience from ODR, not crowdsourcing, more traditional ODR systems. And then, you know, going, pointing to Chris, basically, what are the legal requirements, legal implications of the tools we're developing? What's the role of terms of services? That seems to be the easier part. But what are some of the public law implications, especially going back to the contextual factors and stakeholders? In a government setting, you know, I would imagine you have immediately First Amendment issues. You have, you know, due process requirements and so forth. So I think this is another discussion that we need to have relatively early on when thinking about the design of tools. Now, as I mentioned, our conclusion is there is need for more research, and we are at a stage, I think, where we're particularly interested in doing some deep dives and study some of the tools you're developing and learning from them to get also some data back from it. And the other approach taken by others is just let's build a tool and see what happens, right, which is the rapid prototyping. And I think one of the purposes of this meeting today is in a way to find together and have a combined approach where hopefully, you know, the research informs some of the tool building, and the research then is benefits and is informed through this feedback loop from the practical tools. So this is just to start with a kind of an attempt to map some of the key issues. And I would like to turn over to Joey probably to comment a little bit on some of the issues that you perceive as the most interesting or relevant ones before we open up.
You should be able to take care of all that by two, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that was a wonderful synthesis of things that we've been up to for the past month or so. I think you touched on most of the key issues. I want to go back to the idea of online dispute resolution. It's definitely an animal, as Urs mentioned. I mean, that when you deal with dispute resolution and then when you move it into the online space, there are probably dozens of variables that you have to take into account when you talk about a resolution process. So the project that we're dealing with is how to take an online dispute and take an instance where there's a formal resolution process, say on eBay or say on a government dialogue platform, replace that formal resolution process with our platform where there's a large group of people that's presumably smarter than a small group of people, and use that in a variety of situations to resolve the dispute. So our challenge is to create a platform that's capable of resolving disputes in just about any context in which they come up. So we're trying to design a platform both from a theoretical perspective and from a practical perspective that's capable of dealing with disputes in nearly any context. So I've been trying to think about the different contexts in which a dispute might come up, and that's led us to sort of define a set of use cases. And I think so far, I think for the people in this room especially, the primary use case is government dialogue platforms, public policy. I mean, that's the focus of the eCitizen Foundation. Projects that have to do with civic engagement, public participation, that kind of thing. But I think what our project really aims to do is create a platform that is is flexible enough and scalable enough that it can deal with disputes as they arise in any context. So what I'd kind of like to talk with all of you about is the potential use cases that we might be putting this platform to and how that platform might be involved in resolving those disputes. I think one of the key issues in creating a platform that's capable of not just resolving one kind of dispute, but potentially any kind of dispute, is coming up with a formal structural definition of what a dispute is, than what a resolution is. Daz has talked about defining that in terms of XML or some other structured markup language. And I think that's what we have to do if we're proposing to create a platform that can deal with any kind of dispute. We need to come up with a way of somehow formalizing what we mean by dispute, because otherwise we're not going to be able to plug that into any kind of platform. So a lot of technical minds in here and a lot of people that know these kinds of disputes very well, so hopefully we can sort of work towards that as well. And then the other thing that Urs touched on, which I don't have strong feelings about, but hopefully we can also sort of bring out, is just who makes up the crowd, what are the demographics, because for a lot of obvious reasons, that's very important. I mean, we know that crowds can be wise if the circumstances are right, and we've kind of been led to believe that if a crowd is big, it's going to be wise, but the research doesn't really suggest that. There are a lot of very specific criteria that the crowd has to meet in order for it to actually be better than a small group of experts. We like to debunk the myth of experts, but you know, crowds turn into mobs very quickly unless things are positioned exactly right. So I think that's also very context specific in terms of disputes. So that's another thing to take into consideration.
Good. Make a meta comment, and Urs gave me a little opening here. The notion of a crowd presumes a certain amount of anonymity, and one of the focuses we have, and I have a horse, you know where I'm going to go. I have a horse in this race, is that we think about member networks, and that at some point actually being able to identify persistently people in a network and how they relate to one another is very essential to how it performs. So that if you go with an idea that you can have a crowd which is sort of anonymous and undifferentiated, I think that sort of skews your view, because having looked at self-organizing networks, we had a project here called On Social Physics, which really is like how do you have self-organizing networks? And then out of that came the recognition that identity is extremely important to building trust, and then how do you accumulate reputation, which becomes a part of the governance mechanism. And in that sense, you can't have crowds. You have groups that have a certain identity. So I think that's an important consideration in how to think. I know it's popular to think of crowds as cool, but I think once you drop below that level, then these issues start to surface.
Great. If I could use a word with that, we've moved from communities, crowds, to networks. Yeah. To your point,
or no? And actually, like member networks, to define what you're in a network. You agree to certain principles. You get as a governance mechanism. You're accountable to certain things, and that defines sort of the character of the network.
So, if I could speak to that just for one moment to contextualize part of the dialogue, I think in part we need to have the most open dialogue about all of the relevant issues, and this is a big one. In part, I think it would be useful if we also grounded some of this in what it is we'll be doing together to begin explorations, to see how we can begin to tackle some of them and maybe defer others. So in this particular one, there's something relevant, which is we also perceive what you said as a big issue. And the way that we've addressed it at this point isn't fully by deferring it, but by in a sense, begging the question or obsoleting a little bit by design. We're assuming for purposes of all of our tests that we will already have an identity relationship with everybody that is participating in the test through the course of the summer. We'll know who the mediators are, whether they're randomly selected from public or not. There'll be a gating mechanism first where we'll contact them, we'll ask if they want to participate in a test, we'll agree to terms and conditions that we'll write up, and there'll be known quantities which should deal with some of the issues that deals with the open internet and anonymity. Now within that context, I think we can still begin to once you see the project plan, once you see how we've addressed this, explore what would we do if people adopted this source code and these standards and went so big into such a big list that they didn't have that same level of high gated threshold before with the dispute with the people doing the dispute. It was more like the stranger relationship you're talking about. How would you address that? I think we can begin to explore that, but we're not faced with that at this time because we're not randomly putting the disputes or any part of this out to people that aren't already under contract with us and well known.
Can I ask a question about the just as a theoretical matter to understand the level jumping from individual to group to network and the identity associated with the individuals. One of the things that occurs to me is that that's like in a human body is a system, like these things are systems. You have individual cells, they accumulate to form tissue, which accumulates to form organs, which then perform a function. Those functions can't be performed by the individual cells, they have to be performed in an organ. Is that kind
That's very of much, that's a huge issue. And it's how you, and actually you have an identity and a set of rights and obligations as an individual cell, but then as an aggregate, you have another identity, another set of principles. And so and that naturally is it forms and networks. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so but then it's how do you recognize that and how do you embody it
and name it.
And yeah, no, that's all part of the way of thinking about
so
it.
So the multiple the exercise, the mapping that we just saw seems to be a physiology in a way, all right, or the aspects of the physiology. That's like going to medical school for this organism.
Laying out a taxonomy and understanding mm-hmm. what these different pieces, because there are, I think, a lot of mechanisms underneath, and then they get wrapped in, mm-hmm. rolled up into some buzzword, and you think, oh, now if you really want to make this work, you have to sort of deconstruct it into its various mechanisms. That's part of the research agenda, mm-hmm. is to identify what they are, mm-hmm. and then part of our interest in so the private production laws is recognize you're going to have different networks with different ideas how to do this and succeed differently under different kinds of missions or objectives.
And so one of the things it seems that one of the challenges we'll have within this group and then in a larger process is the how ready people are mentally to do the level jumping, right? To say, oh, I'm an individual, wait, in this context, I'm doing this, oh, wait, now I'm this. And so that jumping up and down those levels and the acknowledgement, I'm not talking about personal acknowledgement,
no.
System acknowledgement of, oh, I'm at this level, that's informed by what's above, it's informed by what's below, and this is how I operate at this level. Oh, now I'm examining things at this level, that's informed. Similarly.
These are different roles that people have, and they're different mm-hmm. kind of, and that is something that we're doing, Yokai is doing experiments in cooperation, the whole social signaling, and how do you signal, mm-hmm. in a sense that people have implicit signals as to what roles and what levels they're working at, and how do you acknowledge that, and how do you design that into your mm-hmm. system?
Right, thank you. If I could just affirm the discussion that was going on, again, this is after 2 years of being into this. This is all about behavior. This is all about change management. And understanding the fact that conflict resolution is more about how people interact with one another, the compromises they're willing to make or not willing to make, how they interpret the set of facts and how they misinterpret the set of facts all manifests itself. And as we started this exercise, we said there's two major pieces to this. There's communities and technology. We thought technology was going to be a real bear. We've concluded technology's on the table, but it's irrelevant. It's all about communities.
Technology of the day
it's
is what, right?
You will find a technological solution mm-hmm. to this if you can address the first pieces, which is what the three of you have been talking mm-hmm. about.
So on that vein, in the eCitizen Foundation, we've also been looking at this. And then before this, there was eCitizen architecture research within the Media Lab that I participated in where we looked extensively at this over the last 7 years. And we've concluded similar things to what you've concluded over the last 2 years. And we just sculpted a little bit differently now in terms of components from today. Well, I'd say the components, I don't think this is a complete set by a wide margin, but that I've definitely identified, and so have our colleagues, are number one, community. One, as you said. And tied for one, identity.
Yes.
Now, where do you, and you know, those blur, obviously, but I'm talking about individual one per human identity and community that you derive from sets of identity. And those are two modules that are deeply connected in some core. And dialogue is another one, which we're really heavily investing. We'll talk more about later. And it grounds our use case. And then architecture within which the modules can fit. These modules and others, in particular, a rules engine, so that you can look at rules, which is the other key component. right? And so rules apply to statutes, they apply to contracts, they apply to processes in ODR, that, you know, it's all over what we're doing. We're coming up with at least interoperable or comparable ways to talk about how we're defining the rules in automated fashions across these, which is good. That's the first step. And then the final one is that our concept going forward is a way to bring all these stakeholders together without prejudging anyone's individual outcomes or business models or anything, is that we're looking to do something where, at least within our little sandbox here, it's very open, like very open kimono. So if you have like super secret stuff, this actually wouldn't be exactly where you would talk about it in this forum, because we're looking to have a lot of sharing here. And what we'd like to do is have talk about what are the models, you know, at a UML level of abstraction that would describe the types of software, types of standards, and types of functions that different people could build to achieve this. So that's how it looks to us.
So I just sort of want to back up to something that Joey brought up earlier about what is a dispute in the context of this project, because you mentioned stakeholders, and is this, and I'm in this from the public policy dialogue perspective on the Recovery Act, and is it a dispute with a government spending practice? Is it a dispute between intergovernment agencies?
Can I address that?
Who are the people in this dispute, and who, if an action is to be taken, so say a citizen has umbrage with the spending the state of Arkansas has done with TARP funding or something like that, maybe all they're doing is making a comment in a public forum, and then this becomes a public dialogue. So that, and I'm, please excuse my naivety.
No, not at all. And level set before the meeting enough. But for everybody's benefit, when we get to that, first of all, let's talk in general as well, general about all the disputes and the ways they could come up, because I think that's the context in which we're doing our project. But just to get some results by the end of the summer, we can evaluate with a test. We picked one almost savagely narrow use case, really, really simple, with very as primitive technology as we could do this with, frankly. It's lowest common denominator, and that is as follows. It's dialogues with government and a narrow set of open dialogues, so-called bubble-up dialogues that Obama has been doing, and that, to some extent, Governor Patrick and a couple of other governors, a few other people have been doing, where you can ask the president a question or ask the Secretary of Health and Human Services a question. You get hundreds and thousands of questions. People rate them, and the top ones bubble up. And that's the type of dialogues we're looking at. So why are we looking at that? Well, partly because we're into dialogue. We have a lot of expertise, and we know a lot about those systems already. And number two, because it generates disputes. So the government right now, which is one of our partners with National Academy of Public Administration, soon NOVAC hopefully will be more interested, and some other folks in the federal government will be giving us use cases of disputes over, should my contribution to this dialogue have been censored or not? Why was it taken out? Someone said it was spam. Someone said it was abuse. Someone said it was duplicative. There's a list of like five or six things in these different ones. Well, Linda had some yet other ones that the state had done, and we'll identify why someone thought it was spam. Then, and that's right now where it ends, unfortunately. Beth Novak will tell us a little more about what they're doing, but what we would like to propose is, from that point forward, we would like to have a generic process that we will postulate in a sandbox now, which would be, once that happened, people rated your contribution as spam, and then it was taken out, you'd be notified, number one, to get to fairness and due process that had happened on your account for the registration. Number two, you have an opportunity to dispute it, which you don't really have in a clean way right now, like a simple button in a form. I dispute this. I don't think this is spam. I don't think this is libel. I think this is legitimate. Do not censor it. Now you have a live dispute with parties, and you can now use our engine, which we'll show you in a moment, to at least give it to people and have them rate it. And then based on, let's say we set it at 70% concurrence that it is or isn't spam or whatever, we'll have to decide that. That would be the initial determination. So that would be one full cycle of a formal dispute and a resolution process based on crowdsourcing. That's savagely narrow. It has a data model of, I think, like 7 lines, which we'll go over later.
Can I say something about this issue of what's a dispute, however? It's an intriguing question because prior to 6 months ago, I never heard it. And all of a sudden, the last 6 months, I hear it continuously. Well, is this a dispute? In my eyes, this is not a dispute. This is a problem. It's a suggestion. It's something. And I'm not sure I understand exactly why that's happening, but came about, the latest project we're doing has to do with electronic medical records. And the more electronic medical records you have, the more mistakes you're going to have in your electronic medical record, and you need some system to correct them. I thought that's a dispute. But everyone, you know, patients I show these things to say, no, that's not a dispute. That's just something else. It's a difference of opinion. It's misinterpretation. We used to know what a dispute was. I can talk a little bit more about this later, but you know, John and I have one common experience, and that is 13 years ago we were at the first conference on online dispute resolution, and there was one dispute. They were looking for disputes then, but there was one dispute. It was AOL throwing off their records high school students. Probably Chris was one of them.
He wasn't not 13 years ago.
He was a little young. And that year they threw off 40,000-50,000 students, high school students, and the people who organized the conference wanted at least to resolve one. That was clearly a dispute, and we have a history. You know, we've got these eBay disputes, but these dialogues, the question is: are these disputes that are part of the process of the dialogue, or is the dialogue likely to generate disputes? Which is the more traditional way of categorizing what a dispute is.